It's Wednesday, March 28th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. For today's show, I was joined by our political editor, Pat Leahy, and our political correspondent, Harry McGee. We talked first about some of the issues that have arisen in what has turned out to be quite a hectic political week. And later in the podcast, we took a closer look at a story which hasn't quite made our front pages, but which has been bubbling along in the media for the last 2 or 3 weeks around the allocation of sports grants. But first, I asked Pat, what kind of a week it had been for our Minister for Foreign Affairs and Taoiseach, Simon Coveney?
He is a busy man, is the Taoiseach and Minister for Foreign Affairs. He was front and centre in a few developments in the ongoing abortion saga. And of course, he was the man who decided, after consultation with his government colleagues, to expel an as yet unnamed Russian diplomat as part of the EU and broader response to the poisonings in Salisbury. So yes, he's a busy man. In fact, as we speak, he is on his feet in the Dáil answering foreign affairs questions.
Is he a damaged politician as a result of his pivot in a column in the Irish Independent on Monday on the issue of the legislation to follow the Eighth Amendment, and then his rather odd statements yesterday in relation to what shape legislation should take?
I'm afraid I think he probably is. Certainly hasn't enhanced his standing either within his own party, according to several conversations that I had with members of it yesterday, or I think with the broader public. Just the background of this is that after Leo Varadkar Taoiseach came out and said that, you know, formally at the end of January that there would be a referendum, that it would seek to repeal the Eighth Amendment, and that the government would then, if that referendum was carried by the people, would introduce legislation to allow for abortion up to, on request, up to 12 weeks, along the lines of the Oireachtas Committee. After the Taoiseach did that, Simon Coveney came out a few days afterwards, and he said while he was certainly in favour of repealing the Eighth Amendment, he could not assent to legislation, or he could not support legislation that allowed for abortion on request up to 12 weeks. And that, I think, was quite a significant departure in the campaign at that point, not least because the great achievement of the repealers and of the government at that stage was to kind of occupy the middle ground, populated at least in part by people who are in favour of repeal but wary about the extension of a liberal abortion law. And certainly that's, I think, what many of them would have interpreted the 12 weeks proposals to be. And Coveney's intervention at that stage kind of arrested that. It at least made that middle ground competitive, or it made it a competed space, if you were.
Although even at that stage he remained in favour of repealing the Eighth Amendment.
Absolutely and unequivocally in favour of repeal. But given the assumption, in the correct assumption, I think, in most quarters, that the referendum will come down not just to the question of repeal but also the question of what follows the current constitutional ban, I think his intervention at that stage was significant. Now, what he did on Monday was to come out and say he changed his mind on the 12 weeks, and that he was now subject to, you know, particular restrictions, particular controls being put in place in the government's legislation. He was now in a position to support the introduction of the 12 weeks legislation. And that obviously caught a lot of people by surprise. But what was perhaps even more surprising is that he followed that up yesterday in yesterday morning's papers with the suggestion that he would seek to have it written into the legislation that future changes in the law on abortion could only be made with a two-thirds majority in the Dáil. Now,
that's unprecedented. There is no other legislation in this state that has such a measure in it, does it?
No, there's not, for the reason that the Constitution says quite clearly that that legislation is passed by a majority in the Dáil, not by a two-thirds majority. Now, I slept through most of the constitutional law lectures in that I went to in UCDU, but I could have told you that after 10 seconds that the proposal was unconstitutional.
So a politician who spent the last 20 years of his life in the Dáil, who's been a senior minister for several years, the idea that he wouldn't know that seems quite implausible.
I find that difficult to believe, to be honest, that Simon Coveney thought that there was a reasonable chance of this making it into the legislation. And was he, and were he to be unsure about it, it seems peculiar that he wouldn't have maybe consulted a lawyer or the Attorney General or anybody else in advance before. I'm forced to the conclusion that what he was doing was signalling, by virtue of this intervention, which he knew was doomed, but he wanted to make it anyway in order to signal his reluctance or his carefulness on the and his caution on the 12 weeks proposal, that he was signalling to people in the middle ground that, look, I'm like you, I'm a bit unsure about this extension of the law on abortion, or a big liberalising move on abortion, and this is one of the means that I'm using to do so.
Is that the wisest of political moves, Harry, to propose something which common sense would tell you is almost certainly unconstitutional as a way of signalling your unease or where you stand on a political issue?
I think, and Simon Harris also initially indicated that he might support such a move. And, I mean, in order to achieve that, the government would have to have another constitutional referendum to allow that to be inserted into the constitution. Because, as was pointed out by Pat and others yesterday, even if a two-thirds majority were required to
that
change
could be overturned
abortion.
by another piece of legislation
that would just require a simple majority. Mm. Now, there are instances where a two-thirds majority are required, but they are all provided for within the Constitution.
Explicitly so.
For example, if one wanted to impeach the President, that would require a two-thirds majority of the Dáil. So there are specific examples, but the net point, the important point here, is that all of them are provided from within the Constitution. I think it's been an unfortunate 2 days for Simon Coveney. He has changed his mind, but in changing his mind, he has given ammunition to those who are campaigning to preserve the Eighth Amendment, that politicians can't be trusted. And that has been a regular meme or theme of their campaign so far. And this will add to the ammunition that they've been using in terms of this propaganda
war. I think we should... You know, pause a moment and say it's not necessarily a hanging offence for people to change their minds on anything. And actually, if you look at, you know, the entire history thus far of the abortion debate, you know, lots of other people have changed their minds. Micheál Martin has changed his mind, and Leo Varadkar has changed his mind, and many other politicians have too, and just as I'm sure many people have. People might go through more than one change of mind on it. But what is peculiar about Simon Coveney's instance is that he... at the time of his February intervention, when he said he was that he couldn't live with the 12 weeks proposal, that by his own admission came after very considerable consideration of the issues. I think he said that he had read the report of the Oireachtas Committee a dozen times. He'd considered it very carefully, and he just couldn't live with the 12 weeks. And it's one thing somebody changing a long-held position that they may have held somewhat reflexively over many years and then considered the issues and changed their mind on them. But it is peculiar. Now, I don't doubt the sincerity of it for a moment, but it is peculiar that somebody should, after very considerable rumination and meditation on it, should arrive at one position. And then a couple of months later...
It does seem a little flaky, Harry.
It does. And as Pat said there, I can't cavil with anything that Pat has said. I think he spent a lot of time considering before arriving at the position where he had difficulties of 12 weeks. And then he has obviously spent a lot of time considering since. But I think he actually needs to come out at some stage And I know that he wrote an op-ed piece for the for one of our rival newspapers, The Independent, on Monday. But I think that he probably needs to explain his rationale a little more. Actually, I was listening to an interview that Tomás Byrne from Fianna Fáil gave yesterday on radio, and he didn't have much of an issue with Simon Coveney changing his mind. I think the big issue he had was that he
No,
made
I'm
such
not talking about the change in the mind. It's the rest. It's the other stuff that
Yes, the two-thirds. Really. It's this very fundamental schoolboy error in relation to how our parliamentary and democratic system works. And that was, if not unforgivable, that was a serious error by him, and perhaps shows that perhaps his research wasn't as deep in some respects as it might have been.
So we've heard confirmation today, or pretty much confirmation, Pat, that the date for this referendum will be May the 25th. I think it's due to be formally announced.
From no less an authority than my colleague Sarah Barden, who has lately tweeted it, so we can take that.
There you are, gospel.
We can take that as gospel. The process at the moment is the bill, the referendum bill. That's the bill to allow the referendum to be held, not the abortion bill that will follow the referendum if it is successful. That bill is in the Seanad this week. It passed second stage in the Seanad after a lengthy debate, which culminated in a vote at about 11:15 last night. So it will go to committee stage and probably remaining stages in the Seanad today. Probably will sail through the Seanad today, and after at that point, that's when the referendum becomes legally inevitable, and I think the government will name the date later as the 25th of May.
And what's the result going to be?
The result of the vote in the Seanad?
The referendum.
The result of the referendum. Well, now we're putting me on the spot. I think, as of now, I think the referendum will probably pass. I think there is an easier route to 50% plus one for the repeal side. I think it is not impossible that it is defeated, but it is a much more difficult ask of the retained side to get to that 50% plus one. And I think that is how it stands at the moment.
And briefly, if you don't mind, you write today about the Strategic Communications Unit and its demise. It was bound to happen, wasn't it?
I remember a report many years ago on electronic voting. I think it was done by Dermot Quigley, a former chair of the Revenue Commissioners. And I think the conclusion of that report was that Martin Cullen did nothing wrong, but it will never happen again. So there's a little bit of the same in relation to this. When you look at the actual report, the Strategic Communications Unit have been exonerated completely.
Perfectly, absolutely.
In relation to this charge that they politicised Project 2040 and tried to manipulate coverage in the provincial papers.
Can I just ask you one question about that? Because I think that's probably true. But the fact is that the relationship with those provincial papers was not directly carried out by the Special Communications Unit. It was by a private company acting on its behalf. And did this report look at what that private company did?
It went into detail. There were two companies, actually, Mediaforce, which dealt with many provincial papers, and then INM, which dealt with titles that were owned by independent news and media. They spoke to officials from both of those. They had access to their emails and to the instructions that they issued to provincial papers. Now, at no stage was a specific instruction issued that advertising copy was to be manipulated so it should look like real news. There was an instruction in relation to the branding. They said the branding and partnership was sufficient, that the word advertising or advertorial was not required. That was a decision that was taken by the media company. And in one instance, one provincial newspaper editor said that the media company had asked it to make the coverage look more newsy. But Elizabeth Canavan from the Department of Taoiseach carried out that substantial report. She interviewed quite a few editors, and they said that there was no pressure put on them, and all the decisions were taken at an editorial level. What the SEU did wrong was that it was too hands-off, actually, ironically enough, in relation to that it sent it out, it issued instructions, and then it had no control on the subsequent copy that appeared. And in three newspapers, the Longford Leader, the Limerick Leader, and the Roscommon Herald, there are pictures of Fine Gael candidates. Those decisions were taken locally. And the point was made by the report that should have been that should have gone back to the SCU, and they should have had ultimate control
over it.
I mean,
we'll have to move on this very quickly, but there's a certain irony here. Is actually, isn't there, Pat, that the SCU, the only criticism of it is it should have gone in and been more political and say, get those photographs of Fine Gael councillors off those pages. It should have intervened in the editorial content.
And perhaps had it done so, all might be well. You know, I'm minded, there's an old verdict in Scottish law, rather than third verdict, not just guilty or not guilty, there's a Scottish verdict which is not proven, which was described to me once by a Scottish lawyer as, it means you're not guilty, but don't do it again.
Yeah.
Okay, on that note, we'll leave it and move on. Now, we did want to take a slightly closer look at a story which hasn't quite made our front pages, but which has bubbled along over the last couple of weeks, mainly perhaps in the sports sections of the newspapers and on radio. It is a story, though, which maybe tells us quite a lot about how the Irish political system actually works and who its winners and losers are. I'm looking at a tweet here, Pat, from a couple of weeks ago from the Minister for Sport, Shane Ross. I quote, "Delighted to confirm that Wesley College has been granted €150,000 as part of the Sports Capital Programme. The funding will ensure the resurfacing of the hockey pitch and will benefit the school as well as the, I think, the local club also." Now, Wesley is a private school in the leafy suburbs of South Dublin. I believe it has a number of hockey pitches, along with two cricket pitches, which implies pretty extensive grounds, some rugby pitches, gym, a number of tennis courts, and a range of other facilities. The minister seemed very proud of the fact that this salubrious establishment in his constituency had received this substantial grant. Is there anything we should be concerned about with that?
Well, the key phrase there is in his constituency, and politicians, particularly ministers, will always try and favour their constituency within and occasionally without the parameters that they're supposed to be operating within. In a way, if Shane Ross was to was to completely ignore this, if he wasn't to claim credit for it, whether he had any hand act apart in it or not, if he wasn't to claim credit in it, that's what would make him unusual. Now, you can say that, you know, Mr. Ross's entire political shtick was that he was going to depart from all this sort of cronyism and so forth. But anything that reeked of cronyism. But there are certain realities, I think, to Irish politics observed by politicians and in many cases demanded by voters that that politicians will always respond to. For the rest of us, I suppose the question is whether that is the best way to run your system of public administration, and particularly whether it is the correct way to run a dispersal system of sports grants so that, you know, privilege and advantage such as enjoyed by the students and staff of Wesley College is augmented rather than being...
Yeah, Harry, I should say that I'm the only person around this table who was born and bred in these leafy suburbs of South County Dublin, and one of the things that I grew up hearing continually from the people around me was that one of the things that was wrong with Irish politics was the worst kinds of flat-capped rural clientelism, where people went up to Dublin to just suck on the national teat on behalf of their constituents as much as they could, ignoring the grand issues of policy and strategy and building a gleaming future for the nation, which urban sophisticates like myself, of course, were committed to, which was all a load of shite, frankly, wasn't it? You know, everybody's out for themselves.
The salient point, Hugh, is that you're the only person on this table who's no longer living in the leafy suburbs of South Dublin.
That's true. That's telling in itself.
All us rednecks have become very posh over the last 10 or 15
indeed.
Years.
Yes, indeed. I've moved to the...
I had a look through
to the glamorous north side, actually, but that's a story for another day.
I had a look through
I feel we're a little off the point here.
Yeah. I had looked through the this year was unusual in that an appeals process was introduced for the first time, but we'll come back to that in a couple of minutes. The I had looked through the initial grants allocation for this year. There's a lot of money that's given out in sports grants, capital grants every year. A lot of it comes from lottery funding, and I can remember going back to Charlie McCreevy's time when he was Minister for Finance, that Kildare GAA clubs and horse racing in Kildare did exceedingly well when he was Minister for Finance. And then he was succeeded by John O'Donoghue. And John O'Donoghue was in Kerry. And if you looked at the projects in Kerry, there was quite a few projects in Kerry. So you find that the minister of the day, you'll always find that the money will sometimes follow the minister, and you'll get projects there.
Always, doesn't it?
Always. Well, indeed. Yeah. And on that very point, on the line, we have somebody who actually knows all about this. Is John Considine is an economist at UCD. He has a particular interest in the economics of sport and in public finance, and has a bit of an insight as a former All-Ireland winning hurler and All-Star, I believe, myself. John, you've been looking at this for years, and exactly what Harry's referring there, the way in which money follows the minister. You have hard data on that, don't you?
Yes, and it's easy to see from the publication of the first round of grants in 1998 right up to present day. So you can see, for example, in the first couple of years, the per-person funding is highest for Donegal, where when Jim McDade is Minister for Sport. And then when he's replaced by John O'Donoghue, Kerry gets the highest per capita funding. And then there's a little bit of a period where there's a minister's in there for a short period and the grants are disbanded, so we don't really have a huge amount of data there. But when they're returned and Michael Ring becomes junior minister in the department with responsibility.
I recall the moment when John O'Donoghue lost his seat in Kerry, and standing up and surveying the very fine hall in which the count was taking place, very fine sports hall, and basically saying, I'm paraphrasing here, but screw you, you ungrateful bastards, I gave you this, was the gist really of what he was saying. And it was a sort of, it lifted the veil a little bit on how this stuff works.
Yes, and if you check some of the local Mayo newspapers after a recent election, you'll see Michael Ring asking whether the voters in particular electoral divisions recognise what he did for them. So I think we kind of expect it to happen. If you have a minister, you expect them to look after the constituency, and you'll see that even the number of grant applications go up. Now, some people put that down to the minister encouraging them, but I think they naturally go up anyway because people realise, look, if we have a minister here, you know, they've been looking after their constituencies previously, other ministers, so why wouldn't they look after us? So I think it's kind of what we expect, and I don't know if there's the same level of gratitude afterwards for let's say, delivery.
Is how significant is the uptick, or is it possible to tell? I mean, are you talking about a 10% increase if you happen to get a minister for sport in your constituency, or is it much bigger than that?
Oh, in terms of per capita, you shoot up the rankings. I mean, you know, Donegal, or even go down the rankings afterwards. Like Donegal slipped back down to something like 22nd when McDade left, and equally Kildare, who, while McCreevy was not the Minister for Sport, the National Lottery funding is routed through the Department of Finance, and since 2005 with Brian Cowan, it's actually supplemented. Kildare went to something like 26th, so it can be a sizable variation, and that's when it's spread across county. But if it's for particular clubs, you know, it's enormous. Now, so for example, in the John O'Donoghue case, that particular club had got zero prior to him arriving there, and then they got three grants totaling $650,000. So for individual clubs, it can be, you know, it can be literally life changing for the club.
Now, I was saying earlier that a lot of the coverage of this issue over the last few weeks since this thing erupted over Wesley has been in the sports pages, and there's been a lot of debate about, you know, whether there's a proper sports strategy in place, whether there should be a moratorium on funding until some of these issues are sorted out. So some very serious issues about whether clubs or areas which are marginalised or less well off are suffering as a result of the process. But one thing I wanted to ask you was, Is this particularly obvious or particularly bad as a phenomenon in sport? In other words, is sport used as a kind of a gravy train for by politicians, or is this a pattern that we see in other areas too, in other areas of government expenditure?
Well, a couple of Jane Souter, who was previously economics editor at the Irish Times, now working in the politics and government department in DCU, has done it for a broader range than just sport, and she's looked at where the money has gone, and she's found that the allocations have also followed the minister, let's put it this way, in other areas such as health expenditure and so forth. Now, what's kind of interesting and neat about the sports one is that it's easy to see, or I should say, it was easier to see, but it's still fairly easy to see. If you look at the early years, it's printed by county and no distinctions is made. And research by people like myself have actually, I suppose, in some ways muddied the waters, because if you check the pages for where this stuff is published, what happened was they realised they were getting a bit of grief for it, and they decided to change it to some extent, you could call it. So they introduced distinctions between local, regional grants and so forth. And then we had the last round where now you have, not alone do you have differences between local, regional, etc., you now have an appeals procedure which was introduced, and while you mightn't get it first time up, you might get it through appeals, and then there was an issue about whether if there's not enough money taken up by the local grants, could you give regional grants the full allocation? So sport is the easiest one to see it in, let's put it that way. So I suppose it attracts more attention. It's clearer, there's no ambiguity what's happening. Whereas in some of the other areas, it's not as clear, because when it gets funneled through a department, it's harder to trace the exact where the money exactly goes.
One of the things that's interesting about this particular case, to me anyway, is that nearly all the other ministers who you've mentioned there have represented rural constituencies, mostly in the West, as a matter of coincidence, Mayo, Donegal, Kerry. The current minister represents Dublin Rathdown. And so a lot of the criticism of this particular incident has been, I suppose, possibly more class-based. And I know I see a quote here from a Sinn Féin councillor, Paul Donnelly in West Dublin, pointed out that there are two schools in Darndale that have no sports hall and have to use a community hall and play their football outside on a piece of tarmac. And meanwhile, you have a school like Wesley, which is by any standards very well appointed, and most of whose pupils are pretty well off, getting this grant. Is this a new element, and is there any validity to that kind of criticism or comparison?
Well, from my perspective, I would also suspect there's a class element, but I think more of it has to do with the way the minister, Shane Ross, is perceived. He's perceived class. I think some of the criticism is levelled in that direction. As to the socioeconomic argument and so forth, and that sort of element of class and where the grants go, these grants are matching grants, so you have to provide a certain level of local funding. Now, over time, the local component, particularly for disadvantaged areas, has been reduced, and it's not as big as for every other area. But the grants themselves are designed to, let's say, get money to stick where there's already money. So if you have to provide a local amount of funding, it means to get these grants, it means that you have a club with people who are able to fundraise. So it means that you're more likely to get the money to stick and generate additional funding. So in that respect, giving a matching grant is a good way of establishing if, you know, this money is going to be well spent. The problem with it, though, is that if you have a disadvantaged area where you have a few local volunteers who are struggling just to keep the sport itself on the road, for them trying to fundraise, plus in an area where there may not be a huge amount of money available for this sort of stuff, it does militate against that. So these grants are very good for what they're supposed to do, but they're not ideal, despite the reduced requirement for matching funding at a disadvantaged area. They're not ideal for that purpose.
Harry.
Yeah, John, just there are two things that I was kind of curious to find out about. The first is this new appeals process. We know the kind of the protocols for the application for the grant. The appeals process is new. Do we know what kind of criteria they use in relation to what bids are going to be successful and what ones aren't? And secondly, I had a look through the grants allocations for this year, both at the initial stage and also at the review stage. And as always, I'm always quick to rush to the defence of Shane Ross. But in fairness to him, there didn't seem to be a huge sway or bias towards his constituency of Dublin Rathdown. I know that a few other institutions there, Three Rock Rovers, I think, a hockey club which is based there, also got €150,000. But when you look at the overall figures, I mean, there are hundreds of grants, some of them for considerable funds, and they did seem to be relatively well geographically spread. So I don't know if you had a chance to look at the disbursement this year and its geographical spread, as it were.
I haven't done it fully yet, but again, I would tend to agree with what you're saying in terms of, because the grants are done by county basis, it would be ideal if we could do it by constituency basis. We'd be able to say, you know, this minister did give so much here. So it's relatively easier when it's a minister from a county that might have at most one constituency, or, you know, maybe a combined county like, or constituency like a Laois Offaly or whatever. It's more difficult when it's a smaller constituency within Dublin, for example. Going back to the appeals issue, I think there's a number of questions there which the comments and clarifications over the last couple of weeks have, I suppose, confused me in lots of ways. Because, all right, first up, we have the issue of when the grants were allocated, it's not clear whether there was money held off, kept behind, in case people were going to be successful with an appeal. So, in other words, was all the money allocated and then, oh, we need to find more money for appeals? Or was there money held back? In other words, was the money held back from other ones that would have got it? That's not clear. Why the appeals process was introduced itself is not even clear, because, you know, did they look back and say, we need an appeals process because, you know, the civil servants haven't been doing their job properly? I find that hard to, you know, I think the procedures seem to me to be quite good. And then Brendan Griffin gave an interview last week where he talked about this process, and he then mentioned issues about the fact that because Dublin hadn't taken up its full per capita funding at local level, other grants were given the full amount. And he seemed to suggest, and I'm not fully clear on this, he seemed to suggest that grants that got funding originally, they were marked, let's say, out of 100. It's not out of 100, but let's say percentage-wise, let's say they were marked out of 100. And if you got 90%, you got 90% of what you looked for. This is what he seemed to be suggesting. And yet, the ones on appeal seemed to get all the money because there wasn't enough money allocated in the first place to Dublin. It seems the sports stuff is getting messier.
It seems very, very unclear. Pat, it seems to me, without wanting to over-egg the cake, that this is a very good illustration of many of the things that are wrong with the way we run this country. There's a kind of clear lack of transparency in what's being described there by John. I wonder why in this day and age you can't geolocate grant recipients and map them against constituencies. That would seem a pretty basic thing, you know, which you could do with your smartphone these days. So why the government can't provide that information is beyond me. The question of the transparency of the appeals process is another one. The question of money following ministers rather than where it's needed is another one. I mean, the question of how the bureaucracy operates that delivers these political favours, because that's essentially what they are, is another one. Well, and the question of a public-private partnerships benefiting people who are possibly more well off than the people who need the money more is yet another one.
Well, with a number of issues there, Hugh, but to start with the one that you raised at first, that this is, you know, the way this country is run, that's true to a large extent, but it's also, this is the way we want the country to be run, because we elect, or many of us elect, politicians specifically to do these sort of things. The expectation that voters have of their politicians is that they will use their influence to pursue these sort of favours, to pursue these sort of this sort of the catch-all term, and John made reference to it, is deliver for the local area. That is what an awful lot of voters want. That is the priority that they have in their minds when they go to elect their politicians, and therefore it's not surprising at all that politicians should seek to do that when they are
the
in
incentives
office.
Are there for them. To act in that everybody way. Everybody involved in it is acting on the basis of the incentives in front of them.
Precisely. So you look at, you know, we'll have an election at some stage in the middle distance. You look at the leaflets that politicians are already dropping out into constituencies, and government politicians will point at the various things that have been delivered for the local area. They will seek to take credit for them, and they will look for votes in return for that. And it's only when people can look beyond that, that you get a change in political culture, that people prioritise, that the politicians do different things. Now, you know, politicians everywhere, it's not a particularly Irish phenomenon that politicians try to look after the local area. Just let me finish this point. But what is unusual in the Irish system is that politicians spend so much of their time and prioritise this part of their work so much, often to the exclusion of their national duties.
Because the other part of this, John, is that, and this is not just the fault of Shane Ross, although he has been a minister who has been criticised for how well he is across his brief, that there isn't a proper national sports strategy or policy, as I understand it. So there is an element of making it up as you go along, which benefits this, you know, this kind of behaviour, as opposed to a more strategic and perhaps a fairer kind of approach to it.
Yes, but one of the big issues here is you get concentrated benefits and dispersed costs. So, you know, I'm down here in Cork, and I'm looking at my local situation, and I see something happening in Dublin, and I go, look, you know, I get upset a little bit, let's put it that way. Whereas if I'm a beneficiary of it, then I'm delighted with this, and I'm delighted to a large extent, because when we vote locally, obviously, so we have our proportional representation, single transferable vote, we have it by constituency, so the benefits are concentrated in a small area, and the costs are dispersed across the country. So you can see why the benefits here, and it's something that can be clearly linked, because you can go and say, I delivered on this particular project, and it's published, it's up on the department's website. And, you know, I might have even sent out a tweet about it, but you can see that the benefits are there. So am I going to, like, vote against who? The government? I then say, well, I'll vote against Shane Ross's party, but of course he doesn't have a party per se. And now, so who am I going to give out about? So it doesn't register on.
So you're saying our system of proportional representation, the single transferable vote of the multi-seat constituencies, inevitably leads to this kind of behaviour?
Yeah, well, for this particular set of grants anyway, you know, they're local, they're very local. In fact, they're called local, and you have to provide local funding. So you go to your local minister, you, and if you've the Minister for Sport, you're even better off. So you can see the concentration of the benefits and the cost. Then, like, when people will look at the cost per county and they go, you know, it's, you know, €10 per person per county. Is that really going to figure on the way a person decides to go and vote the next time? It's more likely to have an impact if you got a grant. You're more likely maybe to go in and go, well, thank you. More likely, although, as John, I don't know who I might ring, so that may not be.
Not necessarily. Harry, I want to give you the last word on this, but that is the system is built really to deliver this kind of behaviour.
Well, absolutely. We have a clientelist system of politics, and the multi-seat constituency, where you have not only you as a rival with somebody from another party, but as in rivalry with somebody from your own party, lends itself to localism. The system has its benefits. It also has its downsides, and this is one of the downsides. Interestingly enough, a few years ago, the Citizens' Assembly was asked whether we should change our system from multi-seat constituencies, and it had looked at all the rest. And it said, despite the difficulties with our system, there are others that are actually worse than ours. One of the things that fascinates me is that if the decision is taken by civil service, by this kind of process of magical osmosis.
Yeah, how does that work?
They sometimes always
telepathy.
End up benefiting
is there
the minister's constituency.
Yeah.
Well, Shane, they tend to be very good cheerleaders, as Shane Ross said, and I can guarantee you as sure as night follows day, that when his election literature goes round Dublin Rat Down, you'll see that the name of Wesley College will be stamped indelibly on those brochures.
Even if Step Aside Garda Station is not.
On that note, we'll leave it there. Thanks very much indeed to John Considine for joining us. Thanks also to Pat and Harry. And that's it for this edition of Inside Politics. Thanks to our producer Declan Conlon and engineer JJ Vernon. Remember, you can subscribe to us on iTunes or your preferred podcast provider. And you can also find us at irishtimes.com/podcasts. Give us an email at hlinahan@irishtimes.com because your views are always very welcome. And you can also always find me on Twitter. But until the next time, goodbye and thanks very much for listening.